Perhaps you have visited Niagara Falls or Yellowstone National Park, or maybe you saw Old Faithful or the Rocky Mountains or the Grand Canyon. Possibly you have stood at the shores of the Pacific or Atlantic Ocean, marveling at the unimaginable expanse of thrashing water. And all of these wonders and thousands more in this grand world, man feels puny, vulnerable, swallowed up in a universe which owes its existence to our mighty Creator. It's in moments like these in which you experience the overwhelming sense of smallness and marvel at the amazing greatness of God. These experiences, as amazing as they are, pale in light of Ezekiel's encounter with the Creator himself in Ezekiel 1. This grand moment has been recorded and described in Ezekiel's first chapter. In some ways, Ezekiel's report is not much different than if we were to hear a report and see some pictures of someone who returned from a vacation to the Grand Canyon. You know what it's like. Those pictures and descriptions simply cannot do justice to the experience of actually being there. Ezekiel is reporting as accurately and skillfully as he can. Yet even with the guidance of the Holy Spirit, his words seem to us sometimes dull and somewhat confusing. We simply cannot see and experience and feel what he experienced. What is this wheel within a wheel? What are the rims full of eyes? What does he mean when he says they went upon their four sides? These and many other descriptions are just so confusing and hard to imagine. It should be noted that among the many descriptions of divine encounters, there are many variations. And this is disturbing to some who tend to find fault with them, claiming that at least some of them are flawed in their portrayals or that they are simply imaginary dreams. Yet, as Ralph Alexander explains, the variation in details is to be expected when one considers the limitlessness of God. Bill Smallman, a name that you might recognize around here, stated, "A vision of God would create impressions that are utterly beyond description. God has a depth and complexity and awesomeness that don't fit into normal words." Ezekiel will have at least three visions of God as he details them in his book. This one in chapter 1 is the longest and most thorough in all the Bible. Ezekiel's description is disjointed. It's excited, just as you might expect from a man who has suddenly been visited by God in such an awesome moment. There seems to be no organized flow in his writing. He moves back and forth describing the key facets of his scene. Christopher Wright says it this way, "This account is full of hasty, disjointed, and ungrammatical language, tumbling along as the words struggle to cope with an overwhelming, awesome confrontation with the majesty of God." This morning we looked at the first three sections of this. We looked at verses 1 through 3 and saw the sad setting in which this was written. We saw the staggering scene in verse 4 through 11 in which he described the cherubim, and then we saw the stunning swiftness with which these cherubim moved as a part of this entire group. Tonight we will continue and we will look at, first of all, the spectacular sight in verses 15 through 23. The spectacular sight, what now is he looking at? He is going to be talking about some appearance of these angelic creatures, and then he's going to talk about their actions, and then we'll talk about the authority that moves them. The appearance of these angels, these are angelic creatures. Verse 15 says, "Now, as I beheld the living creatures." So he sees angelic creatures, and he's already described them. We were not going to go over and look at that again. There are four faces, there are four wings. They're surrounding this chariot with its wings spread out, touching one another. Then he sees not only these angelic creatures, he zooms in and he sees now these great wheels. These great wheels. Verse 15 says, "Now as I beheld the living creatures, behold, one wheel upon the earth by the living creatures with its four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their work was like the color of beryl, and they four had one likeness, and their appearance and their work was as it were a wheel in the middle of a wheel." So these wheels were standing. It appears that at least this one wheel standing next to each other, the four angelic creatures, each one had a wheel standing next to each one. And apparently these wheels came all the way down to the ground. It says in verse 15, upon the ground. So while this whirlwind came from the north and probably from the sky, it comes down and apparently it touches down and the wheels touch the ground. And so it says their color was like beryl. That's a precious yellow or gold colored stone. So these wheels may have been like a gold color. And then it tells us in verse 18, verse 17 says, "And when they went upon their four sides, they turned not when they went." And verse 18, "As for their rims, they were so high that they were dreadful, and their rims were full of eyes round about them four." So these eyes, how many eyes does it take to go around the rim of this wheel? And scholars debate, and they're not really sure exactly what this is. What does it look like? What's a wheel look like with eyes all around it? Kind of an interesting description. One scholar calculated that there were at least 32 eyes and then more all around the wheel's rims. So there's a lot of eyeballs if there's a lot of eyes on this thing. At least 32 plus however many it takes to get around the whole wheel. He suggested that perhaps simply amplifies the idea of an all-seeing deity. He sees all. But these wheels, it tells us in verse 18, are very high and dreadful. I think that really the better way to say that is that they're very tall and majestic or awesome. These wheels were amazing to look at. Now, typically, we don't look at wheels. I know we got a big wheel for my daughter when she was a young girl, and that big wheel was probably about that big, and it was big, and boy, she was pretty excited to get that big wheel. But these wheels are really big and awesome. I'm not sure, you know, when he describes them, I just get this impression it might be like a 6-10-story building height of a wheel, or maybe larger. It was huge, and it was awesome or majestic. And then it says there in verse 16, "As it were," at the end of verse 16, "it was a wheel in the middle of a wheel." I really wanted our quartet to sing tonight. Ezekiel saw the wheel way up in the middle of the air. Ezekiel saw the wheel way in the middle of the air. That's what I want us to sing, because that old Negro spiritual comes right from this text. And it's well known in all a number of different circles. What is this wheel in the middle of a wheel? Some have pictured this in terms of modern-day technology, a gyroscope or freewheeling casters. One scholar described it as two different axles that intersected and that the wheels could then go which way, whatever way it wanted to. I'm not sure I understood what he was even saying, let alone what Ezekiel is describing here. The emphasis, however, seems to be more on function rather than mechanical construction. We think in terms of what did this look like when he says this wheel in the middle of a wheel. The main thing he's trying to get across is how it functioned. Now, we'll come back and talk about that in a little bit more. But the next thing I want you to see here is, as I'm kind of jumping around here a little bit, because Ezekiel kind of jumps around a little bit. But he comes to, in verse 22, I wanted to skip to verse 22 for a moment, and he talks about a platform that is high above. So the likeness of the firmament upon the heads of the living creatures was like the color of terrible crystal stretched forth over the heads above. And then under the firmament were their wings straight, the one toward the other. Everyone had two and covered this side. One covered two, one covered that side in their body. So again, he's repeated himself about how the angels, the cherubim, had four wings. Two were spread out from side to side. And then the two other wings covered their body and probably their legs and their feet. So, but what is he talking about when he says in verse 22, in the likeness of the firmament upon the heads of the living creatures? Most scholars agree that this translation of firmament is probably an unfortunate translation. It really means some sort of platform. So here we've got these wheels and these angels here around these wheels, and these wheels are moving back and forth. And then at the top of that is some kind of a platform. And we'll see later on that that's the platform, and the top of that is where this throne sets, where God is. So it is some sort of platform which seems to be constructed of clear and bright shining crystal, and it sounds similar to the description of the platform upon which God's throne sets in heaven as you read about it in Revelation 4. So I'll tell you what, Ezekiel saw something that is very similar to what is described in Revelation 4 and then again in other places in Revelation 15, for example. And so this platform was raised above the heads of the cherubim. Now, it doesn't tell us it's connected. It simply tells us it's above. But we just kind of feel that somehow this whole contraption, whatever it is, apparatus, is connected together in some way. And Ezekiel notes again how these cherubim had the four wings and how the cherubim's wings are connected to each other on the four sides. He is noticing the various details of this whole scene, but he also notes their movements or their actions. So we got this image of this, the cherubim, he sees them first, then he sees these wheels as a part of this apparatus. Now he's going to talk to us a little bit more about how this whole contraption is moving. So let's look at their actions in verse 17 through 19 specifically. Look at verse 17. It says, when they went upon their four sides. Now, that's a confusing statement. It almost sounds like they tipped over and went on their sides. It says, and they turned not when they went. So really what it's saying is, if they went this way, they just went this way. They didn't turn and go that direction. They went this way. If they went back where they went back, then they never turned is what it meant. So there's an emphasis on direction. They could go in any direction without effort or having to turn. This means forward, backwards, to the right or to the left, or even up into the air. All right, verse 18. And their rims, for their rims, they were so high that they were dreadful, and their rims were full of eyes round about them. For verse 19, and when the living creatures went, the wheels went by them. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. So whatever the wheels did, the angels did. And whatever the angels did, the wheels did. They were somehow almost connected one and together. How did they do this? Wherever, verse 20 says, wherever the spirit was to go, they went. There was their spirit to go, and the wheels were lifted up beside them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. So there's an emphasis on direction. They could go in any direction, forward, backwards, right, left, and up. Okay? But there's an emphasis also on freedom of movement, so that they could go in any direction as fast and far as they wanted. That's the idea here. There's emphasis on direction and movement. Christopher Wright says, the main point of the construction was that it enabled the four interlocked creatures to move in any direction without appearing to swivel or turn. Though the presence of wheels gives a chariot-like feel to the whole apparatus, he says, the multi-directional potential seems to surpass any two-wheeled or four-wheeled chariot. Total and unrestricted freedom of movement seems to be the primary function of these wheels. John Taylor adds, and as if to show that God is not earthbound, the chariot throne can lift itself into midair and fly. So effortlessly mobile is the God of Ezekiel's vision. He can go quickly and anywhere he wants to, as quickly as he wants to. And remember the rapidity, the speed that was stunning in verse 14. They were able to move like the flash of lightning. So we've got this appearance and their actions. Now let's look at the authority with which they moved. Verse 20 says, wherever the spirit was to go, they went. There was their spirit to go, and the wheels were lifted up beside them, and for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When those went, that is, the wheels went, these went. And when those stood, they stood. And when those were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up before them, for the spirit of the living creature was in the wheels. Two times it states that the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. This shows us that though the angels had wings, they were not the means of locomotion. For though this whole unit together had wheels, the wheels did not create motion either. For they were empowered and driven by the Spirit. God Himself is the shaker and mover of this whole apparatus. The Spirit is the one that moves it. And so this whole apparatus moved rapidly and effortlessly at the command of the Spirit. Wherever the Spirit moved, the whole unit moved with Him as a tightly knitted apparatus. And God seems to be perched above this unit in what seems to be a platform, high and lifted above the whole unit. Lamar Cooper describes this. He says, Ezekiel's imagery represents the basic characteristics of the divine nature. Three ways he describes that. Yahweh is seated above the cherubim on his throne chariot as the Lord of creation. The mobility of the wheels suggests the omnipresence of God. The eyes, his omniscience. And the elevated position, his omnipotence. God is above all. He is the sovereign one that sits above this entire thing and can go throughout the entire planet or the entire universe. And so we see this is indeed a very spectacular sight. And Ezekiel is overwhelmed by it. But there's more than just sight. Now he's going to tell us something about the sensational sound in verses 24 and 25. There is some sound, finally, he talks about. Up to this point, all we've been looking at is what he's been seeing. Now here's something that he's going to hear. It tells us in verse 24, and when they went, I heard the noise of their wings, like the noise of great waters, like the voice of the Almighty, the voice of speech, like the noise of an host. When they stood down, they let down their wings. And there was, in verse 25 says, a voice from the firmament that was over their heads when they stood and had let down their wings. So the sensational sound we see, first of all, is caused by the wings. It's caused by the wings. It tells us, when they went, I heard the noise of their wings. So the wings caused some kind of noise. However, it's a little confusing, but I'm not sure exactly why, that since we get the impression earlier that these angels are not moving of their own effort, but they're driven by the Spirit, yet now we're told that wings are making noise. Maybe you have heard these a pair of wings before of a bird when it's rapidly flapping and vibrating. You've heard a flock of geese taking off or a group of pigeons, and you hear it's a fairly distinct noise. Sometimes it can be pretty loud. And this, we are told, is the wings were making noise, and no small noise, because Ezekiel described it here. They must be very powerful wings and flapping extremely quick, because this noise is pretty loud. He describes it as crashing waters. First of all, he says, like the noise of great waters when they're crashing together is the idea. Maybe it's like crashing waves of a turbulent ocean. I don't know if you've been to an ocean time when storms are off the beach and coming in, and you see those waves and they come in, and it just is a loud, loud roar. Or if you've been to Niagara Falls and you stand at the edge of that, and the roar of the falls, and you stand there, and if you try to communicate with somebody, you got to talk really loud so they can hear you, because the roar is really loud. And so these wings, the noise of these wings is creating a loud noise. And he notices that. But he goes on to describe it like the voice of the Almighty. Now, he doesn't say it is the voice of the Almighty. He says it's like the voice of the Almighty. And then he goes on to say, the voice of speech like the noise of an host. So there is a very loud crowd-like roar that emphasizes the volume and the power that is in this motion here. But then he does say that there is a voice speaking from God. In verse 25, he says, and there was a voice from the firmament that is above over their heads when they stood and let down their wings. So God is speaking from above and talking, and his voice apparently overpowers whatever other noise is there. And his voice speaks to us of authority, and it speaks to us of fear. The overwhelming voice of God. Others who've heard this voice have talked to us about it and described it for us. Israel heard this voice at Mount Sinai. It sounded like thunder. And you remember what happened in Exodus chapter 20 when God came down on that mountain and spoke. The people ran in fear, and they came to Moses. They said, listen, you go and talk with God. We'll stand afar off lest we die. They were so afraid of that power and the voice of God as he spoke, they thought it would kill them. Daniel heard that voice. John heard that voice in John chapter 12 when Jesus was there and God thundered out of heaven, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased, hear ye him. And some of them understood that, but some said that they didn't understand it. It sounded like thunder. Well, most of us know what thunder sounds like. And I don't know if you've ever been close to a lightning strike when it hits, but it is so powerful. Even the sound itself can reverberate and shake the earth. I will never forget that day back in 1982 when I was at a summer camp in Illinois. And I was out in a back field and walking and talking and having a good time. And all of a sudden, I felt this rush of wind. And I had seen the clouds moving in. And we all knew there was a thunderstorm coming. And I realized I better hurry back. So I started running back across that meadow. And all of a sudden, without any warning, kaboom! I don't know where it hit, but it was within a mile at least, maybe closer. And it knocked me right down to my knees. And I thought maybe I just tripped and lost my footing or something. But when I got back to the main camp, one of the gentlemen in our group had also been knocked down, not on his knees, but on his face. He actually cut his head. So the power of thunder is the power of God. And I kind of think that when we hear those thunderbolts and see those lightnings, that God is speaking yet today. I think that I see it's always as a warning. God is coming in judgment. Pay attention. Well, we've seen the sensational sound and heard the sensational sound. We've tried to hear it. Let's conclude by looking at the shining sovereign. In verses 26 to 28, now we come to the conclusion. And there's four things that draw our attention to this text in verse 26 and 27 and 28. First of all, there's the repository. Some of you may not like that word, but I had to get an R word, so it's there. And it's a good word. It really is. Repository means something that is a container. It holds something or someone. In this case, it holds a throne. It holds God. Verse 26, and above the firmament that was over their heads was the likeness of a throne. like the appearance of a sapphire stone. And upon the likeness, there goes on to talk about what was there. So there's this throne. Ezekiel has described a chariot with wheels and the cherubim, and now he introduces us to a throne. All of this beginning, he has not yet got us to God himself, and he still isn't a God himself. He talks about this throne that is described as made up of sapphire or like sapphire. And so I just showed you a picture of what sapphire stone is, and perhaps this is what it looks like. I don't know. Sapphire stone is a beautiful, clear, precious gem that is bluish. And it's beautiful. And so its location of this throne is above the firmament. It's above their heads, apparently resting on this crystal platform. And you look in Revelation, describes like this platform is like a sea of glass. And the throne of God sits upon that throne, upon that platform, the sea of glass or crystal. Now we come finally to the resident of this throne, the occupant. Who sits on this throne? It is none other than God himself. And he describes God here, what he sees. Perhaps this whole vision has been building up to this point, and yet there seems to be little which Ezekiel can tell us. Apparently, he's been looking upward and through this crystal glass, and he sees someone sitting on that throne, and he says his appearance, the best he could tell, was he uses two different descriptions there, the likeness of the appearance of a man. Two times he says the likeness, and the second time he says appearance, which tells us, number one, first of all, it's not a man, but it is someone that resembles human form in some way. And then he says the upper part is gleaming metal and the lower part is with brightness. This whole vision has been building, 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 and building to this point, and yet there seems to be little which Ezekiel can tell us about when he sees God. He looks somewhat like a human, but seemed to be hampered by the brilliance of light streaming from within and all around him. Have you ever looked and tried to describe a light bulb by looking at it? It's kind of hard. You've got to get some pretty dark glasses so you can see inside that filament and see the different parts of it. But if it's off, it's not a problem. But when it's light, you know, what do you see? It's just a blinding light. And so he sees this streaming light all around him and coming from within. This agrees with other descriptions of God. 1 John 1:5, God is light and in him is no darkness at all. Hebrews 12:29, for our God is a consuming fire, a brilliant white consuming fire. It's almost somewhat of a letdown. We expect to see more descriptions of God, though this is the longest description of the entire encounter with God in the entire Bible, yet there are other descriptions that give us more details about the presence, the face, the details of God. The most detailed one seems to be in Revelation chapter 1, where John describes the glorified Christ. So we've got this throne, this repository, we've got the resident. Thirdly, he talks about this rainbow in verse 28. Look at verse 28. He says, this fire and this light about it, like the appearance of the bowl that is in the cloud in the day of rain, so was the appearance of the brightness round about. So this is this bright rainbow that apparently encircles this throne, which again agrees with the description that John gives to us in Revelation chapter 4. Now, there's this one little difference that I think, and I think it's here as well. When we see a rainbow, we think in terms of a bowl that stops right here. But in Revelation, it describes a bowl that completely encircles the throne. It doesn't stop as we see it on the earth. When you see it, the rainbow in the sky, you can just tell the ends, the two ends. But you assume that it's got to be complete somewhere. And that's what apparently we get the idea here, that it is a complete bow. And it goes all the way around. The rainbow is especially bright and seems to encircle the throne completely. It is not simply going halfway as rainbows do today. Now, the difference again with this rainbow. Now, you've all seen, how many of you, is there anybody who hasn't seen a rainbow? All right, so you've seen a rainbow. But when you see the rainbows, how bright are they? Not usually very bright, are they? Every once in a while you get a real bright one, but even then you know it could be brighter. They're usually kind of dim and hazy. Sometimes you can barely make them out. But this one seems to be so crystal clear because now God is the one that creates this beautiful bow that goes all the way around. And of course, when we think about the rainbow, it takes us back to the first rainbow, which God made when he made the covenant with all of creation, the promise never to destroy the world again by a flood. So now I think we have a hint in the presence of God of further divine promise coming as we hear about the rainbow, which Ezekiel was privileged to see. There will be judgment, but there will also be a promise on the other side of that judgment. A promise that there will be no more judgment or destruction. Finally, we come to verse 28 at the end there, and it is the response. And this response is what speaks to us more than anything tonight. He says at the middle of verse 28, this was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of God. Again, he is trying so hard not to simply say, I saw God and here's what he looks like. He seems reticent to come right out and say, this was a clear vision of God. This whole vision was so overwhelming that Ezekiel was shaken. And while trembling, he falls on his face before God and the sovereign over all the universe. You and I can do no less. And then finally, he mentions one last statement that leads us to the rest of the book. Notice what he says in the last phrase of verse 28. And I heard a voice of one that spoke. Don't you want to know what he's going to say? Don't look ahead. We'll get there next week. So let's conclude with some application tonight. I would continue with the applications we gave this morning, but I want to start with this one first. This is a little different. I think, first of all, we should meditate on this vision. Meditate on this vision. God gave as a part of his word this amazing vision that he revealed to Ezekiel, like he revealed himself to others, Moses and Daniel and Joshua and others, Paul. And why did he do that? Again, so that they would record and let people know, yes, we have seen God. There is a God. He is the creator. He is the one that we worship. He's the God of Israel, and he's the God of the church. He is the God of creation and the universe. Meditate on this so that you and I can recognize and think about this God that we're going to someday see face to face. Meditate on this vision. Number two, believe. We talked about that this morning. Don't be one of those that say, I have to see him to believe in him. Don't be a doubting Thomas. Be a trusting, believing Christian that is blessed, as God says, those that have not seen yet believe. We have heard the documentation of these eyewitness accounts, people who have seen God, and we can believe. Thirdly, stand in awe. We talked about this morning. This is an awesome display. And we may not be able to stand at the rim of the Grand Canyon, but we can stand in awe. When we hear this great description of who God is and how he came, we should stand in awe and recognize who he is. Fourth, we should draw near to God. We talked about that this morning. Draw near to God. God came near to Ezekiel, who was far away from his temple, far away from Jerusalem, far away from where the Ark of the Covenant resided in the temple. That was supposed to be the locus of where God dwelt. And now Ezekiel is a slave in a labor camp in a foreign country, foreign gods, terrible radical culture, anti-God, and he feels like the rest of them that God has abandoned them. And God comes to them and he draws near and he shows this vision to them to let them know, I am still here and I'm still on the throne and I haven't made any mistakes. We can trust God and we can draw near to him. Number five, listen to his voice. Listen to his voice. That's what the rest of this book is going to be about. This is the one who is speaking and communicating. Years ago, my two daughters were visiting together in New York City. And as they were walking down a sidewalk, all of a sudden, one of my daughters said to the other, when they passed somebody, said, that's Tim Tebow. And the other one said, no. And she looked again and said, that's Tim Tebow. And she said, no. And finally she says, I'm going to go see if I can get my picture with him. She turned around and ran the other way and caught up with this guy, and it was Tim Tebow. And she asked Tim Tebow, now that's all you want to know, right? You want to know what he said when she found there, when she got there? And she got her picture taken with him. Do you know what she said to him? Do you know what he said to her? You want to know? I'm not going to tell you. Forget it. You see, we all want to know. If one of your friends meets up with some great figure or some important person and they got a chance to talk to them, what's the first question you want to ask them? What did they say? What did you talk about? Listen, folks. There's an encounter here with someone much greater than the President of the United States or some football star or some other person. This is not a grand celebrity. This is God himself. He got to see God. And my question is, what did he say? What did he say? And Ezekiel says, let me tell you what he said. And he wrote it down. So we need to listen to his voice too. All this vision is a prelude to the message which Ezekiel will now receive. At the end of it, all a proper fear and reverence for God will demand that we listen carefully and respond in obedience. One key thought which we may gain from consideration of other places where God appears, and especially when we see him on his throne, we may expect both judgment and glory. Whenever God comes, there is judgment for sin and there is glory to follow. When our holy God comes to sinful man, there must be judgment. But we may also look for his amazing glory. This will show up repeatedly in Ezekiel's prophecy. It is the theme of this book. We see divine judgment and we see divine glory, both in the past, as he also gives prophetic visions of divine judgment and glory for the future. The divine glory is nothing less than the creation of the beautiful messianic kingdom, the millennium. So listen to his voice. Finally, rejoice in hope. Rejoice in hope through Christ. You might say, is Christ in Ezekiel? You better believe he is. He has prophesied in an amazing way, and it's beautiful. Now, I told you earlier there was a song that is well known that came from Ezekiel chapter 1. What is it? Ezekiel saw the wheel. There's another song that is well known that comes from the book of Ezekiel. Them bones, them dry bones, them bones, them dry bones. How many of you ever heard that song? Ah, you see, it's a popular song. Everybody knows, well, I say, most people know about Ezekiel saw the wheel, and most people know about them bones, them dry bones. And it's amazing that those two songs illustrate two of the most important issues when we look at the book of Ezekiel. One of them talks about the glory of God. Ezekiel saw the wheel and the glory of God in that amazing vision. as he comes, and he's going to come in judgment and then in glory. And then he talks about in chapter 37 is where we read about the bones, them dry bones, this valley of dry bones, skeletons, corpse. And it pictures the nation of Israel. And Ezekiel comes and he prophesies to those bones like the Spirit tells him to. And those bones come together and they flesh comes upon them and they are resurrected. It's a resurrection. And it's a picture of the resurrection of the nation of Israel. There is hope even in the darkest death valley, in the valley of dry bones. Because when God is there, there is hope. No matter where Christ comes, there is hope. Both of these songs summarize the main message of Ezekiel. God has not forgotten his people Israel. He shows himself in their darkest hours and delivers a glorious message of future hope. In the wheel vision, Ezekiel sees God who comes to them in their darkest hours. In the dry bones vision, Ezekiel sees the resurrection of the nation of Israel and the revival in the promised land. I came across an amazing discovery this week about the national anthem of Israel. Now, you may have heard it, I don't know. They played it, I think, maybe once in the Olympics. But the words you might not have recognized because they're not in English, they're in Hebrew. But here's the words of Israel's national anthem in part. Four lines. Our hope is not yet lost. The hope of 2,000 years to be a free nation in our own land, the land of Zion and Jerusalem. They have got a biblical hope that is pulsing through their hearts and their minds. And those people in Israel, they want that land to belong to them. They know that God has promised it to them, and they still have that hope. It's their national anthem. This anthem embodies Ezekiel's hope and all the exiles of his day, all the way until today as well. This book will give amazing details about Israel's final restoration, which also applies to believers today. Rejoice! God has not forgotten Israel, and God has not forgotten us. Their hope is also our hope. Their hope is the millennial kingdom, and we hope for that too, and that's why we pray as Jesus taught us to pray. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, what? Thy kingdom come. And he will come. He will bring his kingdom. That's what we're looking for. And that's what the whole book of Ezekiel is leading towards. It's exciting.